Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Sally L. Cordy, and welcome to Public Advocate. I am going to pick up my first guest, who is Kathy Sinnott of Ireland. She's a former member of Parliament and a very compassionate woman, tremendous activist. Hello, Kathy.
Hello. Hi, Sally. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, perfectly clearly. Please set out for our audience what the threat to children in Ireland are and where you are currently with regard to a challenge of the referendum.
Okay. Well, in Ireland, last November, we had a very quickly called, very one-sided referendum campaign on what was called children's rights. Now, the amendment itself was sidelined. People were led to believe it was about protecting children who were abused, which, of course, was not what it was about. It was about the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child and the new right of a child to be completely autonomous from his parents and under the control of the state. And not there wasn't anyone informed of that. In this very flash, quick, one-sided referendum campaign. Well, during that campaign, a wonderful citizen called Mark McChrystal took a case against the government because they were using taxpayers' money to convince people to vote yes and were misleading the people about what the referendum meant in their website and literature and the things that they were spending this over a million euros on. And I know in the U.S. a million euros may not sound like a lot, but if I can explain, in a presidential campaign in Ireland, the maximum a candidate can use for a national campaign, in other words, to lay out his stall to the whole nation, is 750,000 euro. So in other words, that's considered more than sufficient to get the word into every home in the country. So the government, on top of a very well-funded yes campaign by every other group, the government used our taxpayers' money to spend an additional 1.1 million convincing us to vote yes. Well, Mark McChrystal took this to the High Court, lost in the High Court, appealed it, but in the Supreme Court he got a unanimous decision of five Supreme Court justices that the government had both cheated and lied, or as they put it, they had produced unfair, they had spent citizens' money, you know, taxpayers' money, they had been unfair in doing so, and they had misled people in doing so. So I put the term cheated and lied because that's really what those synonyms mean. But anyway, the result came out that although the yes side expected 80% of the population to unknowingly vote to give away parental rights, all parental rights for all children, with this McChrystal case, with the government being found out less than 24 hours before there was no more communication allowed about the referendum, many people didn't vote, deliberately stayed home, and some people then voted no. So the referendum, instead of being 80-20 as they predicted, wound up being about 55-45 and a very low poll. So we have challenged this result. The Referendum Act in Ireland allows you to challenge the result in a woman called Joanna Jordan, an ordinary voter, has challenged the result. And it's been the most wonderful process because people all over the country have helped in every way. They've, you know, gone on the internet and found every scrap of evidence. They've donated money. They've given lots of arguments. They've presented themselves as witnesses. Just in every way, there has been incredible help with this. It's a real people's case. And the stakes are very high because it's a double case. On the one hand, we're saying that the result of the referendum is unsafe. In other words, it's not reliably the democratic will of the people because of the interference. Now, that, from a previous court case, is almost virtually impossible to prove. That's what the courts have decided in a previous case. So we're taking a second case, the same woman, Joanna Jordan, is taking a second case, a constitutional case, against the Referendum Act, saying that the Referendum Act is unconstitutional because if we have a right to appeal a referendum, it has to be possible to do so. It can't be impossible. That the criteria cannot be on the citizen who has been offended by cheating, that they must prove the referendum result would have been different, that the onus should be on the one who did the cheating, in other words, the government, to prove that it didn't. And also, the degree of cheating, regardless of the result, the seriousness of the cheating should disqualify that side from benefiting from cheating. And that's sort of the soccer, you know, the football argument, that a referee could see somebody touching the ball or handling the ball or whatever and let it go because he didn't think there would be any goal scored. But if a goal is scored, it will be disqualified because you can't benefit from doing the wrong thing. So we're going to make that argument. It's a double case. Obviously, the arguments are the opposite. In the one case, we're trying to prove that their cheating affected the result. In the other case, we're trying to prove that it's impossible to prove if something affected a case and that that's the wrong criteria. So the stakes are high because if we lose, then we have lost parental rights. We have lost the true rights of children and the family in Ireland. We have introduced forced adoption. We have introduced the government being able to sit in judgment on any parent because the government will decide the best interest of the child. And the government doesn't even have to do anything because according to this wording, the government can decide that the parent might do something. Or the child might, you know, be at risk and take a child and forcibly adopt a child. The second thing is the stakes are high because the government is planning many referendums. They are trying to dismantle our wonderful constitution, have a constitutional convention at work right now, which nobody asked for, to rewrite the Irish constitution. So we have many referendums ahead. And if we win, those referendums will have to be fair and free. There will be penalties for cheating. If we lose, then there will be nothing to stop government from doing whatever they like to push those referendums through, regardless, and if they get the wrong answer, to run them over and over again, as they did in the Lisbon referendum, the Nice referendum, and the divorce referendum. So stakes are high. It all starts on Tuesday in an open hearing, which is unprecedented. It means government ministers will have to come and sit in a witness box and be asked why they cheated. And it's all very exciting, especially for people who have been following it and who have been supporting it. And I really want to thank you for letting us talk about it on your show.
Well, I'm very excited that you have a second case going, a case that will call them to task. I can't help but wonder when you say the Supreme Court judged that they had cheated and lied, basically, why the referendum vote was not at that moment thrown out.
Yes, we all question that. The judgment was, the full judgment was not handed down till after the referendum. All that was given was a very short preliminary judgment just saying that it wasn't fair, impartial, and it was misleading. And then they said, but at this stage, you know, we think the referendum should go ahead. Now, that's a serious question to all of us. Why should it have gone ahead? You know, it obviously was seriously contaminated. Now, it worried us because, but when we saw the full judgments by the Supreme Court, several of them made an enormous point about the importance of referendum and the importance of the sovereignty of the people, and that nothing should tamper with this. And it really gave us courage to go ahead and challenge this. It gave us a lot of things, a lot of very important language to work with in this case. So we have gone ahead. It will go to the Supreme Court, because if we win in the High Court, the government will appeal it. If we lose in the High Court, we will appeal it. And in the McChrystal judgment that this case fits on, you know, where they prove that the government cheated and lied, Mark, as I say, lost. Mark McChrystal lost in the High Court, but got a unanimous victory in the Supreme Court. So this will go through to the Supreme Court. And so, you know, we are going to have to watch this space for the next couple of weeks in the High Court, and then probably quite quickly after in the Supreme Court.
The second charges that were brought by, would you say this lady's name again, Joanne?
Joanna Jordan.
Joanna Jordan. The second case, would that have a criminal prosecution for those who did lie?
Well, you know, the thing is, we would feel that this is such an important offense. You know, to tamper with the most, if you like, sacred citizen responsibility in Ireland, which is the referendum, the right of referendum, the right to protect our constitution, the right to change our constitution. That was tampered with, I think, is absolutely an absolutely serious, serious offense.
I would like to make an analysis, if I may. For example, Paul Thorson wrote articles saying that vaccines and autism have no link, and he also is on the run for a tremendous amount of money for research, and he's one of the FBI's most wanted. Now, here he has done something that has left many, many children injured. But the crime they see is in absconding with the research funds. So he's a criminal because of that, as with the tax dollars having been used to dupe the Irish people or disinform them. Would the criminal charges then be affiliated with the taxpayers' dollars?
Well, I would think so. I think that if you if you defraud the taxpayer of money, certainly if the Revenue Commission thought you were defrauding, you know, you'd been given a grant or something and you had spent it, you had defrauded the taxpayer, they would certainly be coming after you, probably with criminal charges, but certainly for reimbursement. So, you know, I certainly feel that
it's just so ironic that the real crime is not the one that may bring them down, but the monetary issue. And that's fine. However it has to proceed, it should proceed.
Yeah, well, remember, Al Capone was not brought in for murder, you know. For all the people he had killed, he wasn't brought in for murder. He was brought in for tax evasion. And I think that was the policy at the time, you know. We can't get him for murder. We can't get him for bootlegging. We can't get him for all of this. Let's get him for tax evasion. So whatever way they got him into jail, they got him into jail. And but certainly in this case, if they're not forced to reimburse the taxpayer, what consequences are there in the future? I mean, even if they lost the case, if there's no consequences, they come up to a referendum that they feel they must pass, maybe because Europe is on their back or the IMF or the UN or whatever, then they'll just do it again and just wait for someone to go to all the trouble of coming after them again if there are no consequences. So I really feel
that... Now, another issue is the intent to cause harm, because to separate families without cause is harmful under anybody's definition.
Oh, absolutely.
So
absolutely.
As vaccines, 100% poison, are harmful by anybody's definition. Yes. So there's an intention to cause harm even in presenting such a referendum.
Yeah. Well, we would first have to prove to the judges that it was going to cause harm. And the actual, which I don't think would be too difficult, you know, to actually prove this is about eliminating parents' rights. And in fact, there were several judges during the campaign were lone voices in saying this is not necessary. It's not going to help abuse. That what's needed to stop abuse is already in the Constitution. It's just not being used. You know, there were judges that warned this was not all it seemed to be. But the thing is that in the case, we have not argued the actual issues for the simple reason that the Referendum Act allows us to petition the result. It doesn't allow us to rehash the arguments. In other words, if we petition the result, if we get it declared unsafe, then the referendum is run again, and then we can argue the arguments, you know, but that's not what the courts will be dealing with, are the actual arguments or the substance of it. But for me, the bottom line is that we get that the referendum result is declared unsafe and is not ratified, and two, that there are very, very severe consequences in the future for cheating and lying that puts manners on everybody because, you know, whether it's an election or a referendum, there is absolutely, I mean, you know, you blush to hear what's said knowing that candidates or that people advocating one side in a referendum know the truth. And it's absolutely embarrassing to watch people say anything that they want to get their yes vote or get their vote. And in fact, recently, our Minister for Education, you know, who's supposed to be a role model for students, for children, he was brought up on something that some election promise that he had absolutely reversed, totally defaulted on. And he said, well, what do you expect? I said that during an election. Basically, that was his attitude. Oh, I said that during an election. You know, that doesn't count. To me, truth is truth, you know. And, what you tell people during an election has to be what you absolutely intend because that's what they're voting on. So you have to give them adequate information and accurate information.
Okay. Kathy, what I would like you to do now, if you would, is tell people the real threat. What is the genuine outcome? If a child is taken by the state, what may happen to them?
Well, I think in Ireland, we already have a situation where we have secret courts. In other words, there's an in-camera rule, which means that there can be no reporting. There can be no listing of names. There's no record keeping on how a judge came to a decision. It's very, very arbitrary, and it's very, very secret. And, of course, things grow in darkness and secrecy. You know, I mean, we want transparency if we're going to have things that are going to be just and they're going to be honest. And we don't have any transparency. Now, we could, obviously, the excuse is that they want to protect children. So we could have an anonymity without secrecy, where cases can be reported on without the names. And this works very well in some cases. There are some cases in criminal law, et cetera, where you can't report the names, but you can report the case. And this would throw open these courts. But anyway, in Ireland, we have a lot of abuse going on in these courts because these courts basically are following the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. Social workers go in and tell the judges, psychologists, whatever, that in their opinion, the best interest of this child is X, Y, or Z. And regardless of what the best interest of the child is. Now, this is not to say there aren't parents who absolutely are getting it wrong, who malicious parents possibly, etc. But from the cases that I know and that I hear of, this isn't what we're talking about. We're talking about parents who, if they're failing at all, they're failing because of poverty, because of illness, because they need some more support. And in many cases, the parents aren't failing at all. It's just maybe they're homeschooling or maybe they're, which the Constitution specifically allows. Or maybe, you know, there's a vendetta against them because they refused a vaccine, or, you know, it can be any number of things. Or there's an overzealous new graduate social worker who's, you know, trying to get a number of cases under his or her belt. And, you know, it can be any number of
things. What if the child is taken away? I have heard absolutely hair-raising stories from children who have been stolen by the state about how they have been abused, how drugs have been tested on them, how they have been trafficked. These are the issues that you are standing between. You and Joanna Jordan are standing between a horrifying fate for these children and their family. This is the most important case in this regard. I want people to understand this because Kathy Sinnott and Joanna Jordan need legal funding to keep this case going. Now, while you are fighting these fights, the good fight, while you're fighting these fights, they cannot enact this resolution that was taken, this referendum.
No, the president hasn't been able to sign it. And you're absolutely right. You know, children are being separated from their parents. I know of 5 children now that have been taken, very young children, babies in maternity hospitals, and 5 that I know of personally who have been taken from their parents. Their parents have not been allowed to raise them. In one case, has only raised them for a few months under total scrutiny. Good parents. And it almost seems like to accumulate babies, to have babies ready when forced adoption comes in. And the thing is, what we don't yet have in Ireland is forced adoption. What we do have is a system of state institutionalization and through foster care and through institutions. And whereas many foster parents are very good people, many of these children have loving parents who are capable of parenting, and in some cases, you know, if they even had a modicum of the funding given to, like, you know, a foster parent will be given €350 a week to take care of a child, where the parent who maybe can't pay their mortgage, etc., won't be given a euro extra a week to keep their child. And this is one of the incredibly sad things that's going. I was dealing with one mother recently whose 12-year-old son was taken, a single mom, her only son, was taken after she went down to social services, and it was a very cold snap in the winter, and explained that she just can't keep the apartment warm. She just does not have money, that it's down to fuel or food for her son. And that she doesn't. And that night, social services arrived on her door and took her son. Rather than giving her, say, 20 extra euros or a bag of coal a week, they took her child, gave him to a family with 3 other foster children who are getting 350 euros a week for each child to keep their house nice and warm. And this is the kind of thing that's happening. Now, the difference between Ireland and the UK is we don't have forced adoption, but if this referendum comes in, then we have the possibility of forced adoption. It's in the wording of the referendum. And then we will go the way of the UK because our government, which is broke, is spending a lot of money on foster care and would like to start sending these children into adoption. Now, we all know that people are not looking to adopt 7-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 15-year-olds. They're looking to adopt babies. But once that possibility is there, then it's the babies, including these 5 young children that have been on 3-month temporary foster care orders for some of them 2 years now, will be all ready to be adopted out while they have loving mothers doing everything they can and fathers to be able to raise them. And it's absolutely dreadful.
I would like to say that this is already passed in the UK. Am I correct?
That's right. It's not only past
and
the
date. And I want to say that Bridie, who is a mutual friend of ours, while I was talking to her about your case, she said, excuse me, we were online, and she went away and came back, and she said, that was a mother from the UK on the run with her daughter. I just gave them some food. Okay,
yeah.
While we're discussing this, she gets a knock at the door, and it is a mother on the run with her daughter to prevent child stealing, on the run needing food in Ireland. Give me a break. This is how real it is. So
well,
please,
right.
everybody, take this so seriously, and please help former Member of Parliament Kathy Sinnott, who is a champion of children and of disabled children especially. I have to pick someone else up, Kathy, but I really want people to understand the realness of it all, and that you are standing between a catharsis, a catastrophe for the children of Ireland and their loving parents. So I'm so happy to know you, Kathy.
And we have a real opportunity here with this case. We can win this. It's a great case, but we do need support in this. And I would ask people not only for financial support, prayers as well, please. We need to win this.
Well, I have to tell you, I called out to God, and the next thing I know, I'm very serious about this. I said, God help me. Seriousness of these issues that I am working on, be it vaccination or be it the issue that you're trying to prevent children from being stolen and thrown into God only knows what kind of an environment and abuse. And do you know that the vote came from the Supreme Court thereafter? Within a week, that happened.
The U.S. Convention on
the Rights of Disabled People got shot down, and three other really important things happened. So I do believe in prayer. I do call God. By all means, He's listening.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Sally. Thank you so much.
Bye,
and
my friend.
Slánce to you
and the children of Ireland.
Great. Thank you so much, and we'll keep you updated.
Wonderful.
God bless.
Indeed. Hello?
Yes, Sally?
Is this Paul Galley, the riverkeeper?
This is he. How are you?
Well, I just got off the phone with a woman that I... Really, we are so lucky to have people of her intellect taking on these outrageous situations of child stealing by the state. It's happening. It's happening in Canada. It's happening in the UK. And there doesn't even need to be a cause. You know, that's just reeks of trafficking to me. Paul, let us talk about while you're on. I'm just, this upsets me to such a level I can barely speak sometimes. But you are the river keeper, and your job is to keep the Hudson River clean and to keep the drinking water clean. Am I correct about that?
Absolutely, Sally.
What is the greatest threat to our drinking water and the Hudson River?
Well, I think there are three: the Indian Point nuclear power plant, hydrofracking, and the fact that we're not keeping up our infrastructure and that water treatment plants are being allowed to slide and the levels of contamination can be very high.
I went up with a lovely woman, I'm trying to remember her name at the moment, who is with Riverkeeper. Her last name begins with a P.
Tina Postman?
Well, anyway, I made some videos when we went up to shut down Indian Point public meeting. Did they extend that license?
No. It's a real pitched battle. But there's some good news there. You know, it's a pretty nice spring day, and we all need some good news from time to time. You know, Governor Cuomo and the Public Service Commission literally ordered Con Edison to come up with alternative supplies of power for when Indian Point's licenses expire in 2 years. And that was the signal that other energy suppliers needed, and they're flocking in. And when those licenses expire in 2015, we will be ready to pull the plug.
Well, that's pretty amazing. So you're saying that this is not going to be extended if Cuomo has his way?
Absolutely not. He's long been on record saying it never should have been built there. His father was famous for preventing Shoreham from operating out on Long Island. You know, just this week passed, you have the former chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is the chief regulator for the nuclear industry, saying that each and every one of the nation's 104 nuclear reactors has a serious enough safety flaw that it should be closed down. And then you have a report by the GAO, I love this agency's name, the Government Accountability Office, and they issue a report saying that the evacuation plans for the nation's nuclear reactors are based on complete fallacies that people outside the 10-mile zone will not try to evacuate in great numbers. You know, the people inside the 10-mile evacuation zone don't know where to go. Marist College did a poll right after 9/11 when people's attention to emergencies was very high, and they said, do you know where to go in case of an emergency at Indian Point? Only 3 out of 100 people knew the answer to that question.
Well, what's the answer to it, Paul?
Well, it depends upon where you live. You know, if I'm over in Ossining and something goes wrong, I go to White Plains Hospital. White Plains High School. There are a number of different evacuation routes, but again, this is something that nobody really knows, and that's for the folks within the 10-mile zone. People up to 50 miles away are at serious risk if there's an accident at Indian Point, and there's 20 million. New Yorkers, residents of Connecticut, residents of New Jersey, within that 50-mile zone, and there's no way you're going to evacuate them. You're living in a dream world if you think that we can evacuate safely after an accident at Indian Point. And then...
Well, I have a question for you because I have been looking for the answer to this, and you may be just the person. We know that Indian Point is built on a fault line. I understand all of our nuclear facilities are built on fault lines, which really leaves you no option but to say why. Why would nuclear facilities deliberately be built on a fault line? Secondly, the Hurricane Irene and Hurricane Sandy I'm sure these nuclear facilities were affected by those, and yet there has been no report in terms of how devastated our water is, or our air. Has there been a report in terms of how those hurricanes have affected our nuclear power plants?
Well, first, the question of the fault lines. I can't say that all 104 reactors in this country are built on fault lines, but I can tell you that Indian Point is built at the intersection of two of them, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued a report in 2010 that analyzed data for risk of a meltdown in the result of an earthquake. And the most at-risk nuke plant in the country for meltdown after an earthquake is not in California. It's in New York. It's Indian Point. So the issue is
dead serious. Well, I tell you, I called
serious.
The governor when Hurricane Irene, I didn't think to call the governor, but Hurricane Sandy, I did call the governor, and I said, shouldn't you be shutting down that nuclear power plant? Because I think it's going to be affected. They actually had a plotted course for this hurricane to follow, and that's certainly why did we shut down the nuclear plants during the hurricanes or not?
One of the two reactors closed at Indian Point, but the reactor that was most at risk because of Hurricane Sandy was Oyster Creek in New Jersey, which is close enough to the metro area to do all sorts of horrible things should there be an accident there. And the water levels got so high that it very, very nearly compromised that reactor. And Sandy, everybody says Sandy was this horrible superstorm. It was only a Category 1 hurricane. So if you get a Category 2 or 3 hurricane with the same course and the same high tide, you're going to end up with serious, serious risk of damage to Oyster Creek or Indian Point. You know, you can pick your poison with these nuclear power plants. Either there's an earthquake risk or there's a risk of flooding, or, you know, at Indian Point they don't have adequate fire safety regs. They've been given dozens and dozens of free passes from fire safety standards. That same Nuclear Regulatory Commission chairman once said that there aren't two nuclear plants out of 100 in the United States that are complying with all the governing fire safety rules.
I've always wondered about the River Keeper. I have always wondered if your office was on a boat.
Well, it's funny you say, because in Hurricane Sandy, we have our boat out in the marina in Ossining, and our offices are right down at the water level in Ossining, right by the train station. And we were bailing to keep the water out of our offices, and John Litzcomb, our amazing boat captain, was out on the boat keeping it safe and rescuing a number of other boats from the Westerly Marina in Ossining, where we're located. So we're right down there by the water. We're right in harm's way just like everybody else.
Actually, I always thought that that would be a big plus, but I guess when you think in terms of hurricanes, it's no plus. So now what are the components that are threatening our drinking water? What exactly are you trying to prevent from entering the water? What harmful components are you trying to prevent from entering the water supply?
Bacteria is a huge, huge threat. Pathogens of all sorts sicken between 1.5 and 3.5 million people in this country every year, and that's just from recreation on the water. Only half.
What would cause the bacteria?
Well, contact with human or animal waste is the main cause. You know, when we have a big rainstorm, a lot of our cities have combined systems for the stormwater and the sanitary sewage from the buildings. And when there's a rainstorm, there's too much rainwater in the system, and the plants that treat the wastewater have to get bypassed. They call them combined sewer overflows, or CSOs. And these events, you know, in New York City alone, there's 30 billion gallons of combined rainwater and sanitary sewage that's discharged every year because of these storms. That's the bad news. The good news is that it used to be at least 50 billion gallons, and it used to be a lot more sewage mixed with a lot less rainwater, and the city has spent billions of dollars on improving their system and storing the rainwater and making sure that they bypass as little as possible, and they're about to spend billions more on new techniques to try to keep the rainwater out of the system so you can treat the sanitary sewage and use the rainwater to grow things, God forbid.
Right. A lot of people talk about fluoridation in the water. Do we have fluoridation in New York City's water supply?
We do indeed.
And do we deliberately have that, I presume?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I guess that's a thing from back in the 50s, I remember. Although I was born in 1959, so I don't remember it that well.
Well, can we get it out of the water? Can we prevent it from being put in the water?
I don't think we can. I think right now our job is to keep the bacteria out of the water, keep the pathogens, keep the chemicals that can come from spills. You know, if you have polluters, they can end up saddling you with oil pollution, with toxic chemicals. They can saddle you with this fracking fluid if fracking gets anywhere near our water supply. And this is a
problem.
Would
you explain the chemicals that are used in fracking and what health risks they pose to New Yorkers?
Well, these are neurotoxins. These are carcinogens. They're chemicals that are used to make this water. They shoot as much as 8 million gallons of water down into these bedrock formations in order to crack them open. And they put sand in there, and they put these chemicals to increase, the, believe it or not, the slipperiness of the water to get the sand deeper and deeper in and get more of that gas out. And, you know, they don't disclose all the chemicals that they use. There's as many as 300 chemicals. And they made a big deal in Texas of saying, well, we're going to disclose and we're going to let people know what we're using. But they had a loophole that said that if they argue that it's information that the company owns and that would put them at a disadvantage if it was disclosed, they don't have to disclose. So long story short, in Texas, they only disclose 80% of the chemicals, and the other 20% are probably the ones we have to worry about.
Well, we only have 5 minutes left, so I would certainly appreciate if you would like to make an announcement about the Fisherman's Ball this Tuesday, April 16th, and tell I have underneath this radio program the link where people can purchase tickets. But if you'd like to give them a little information, it sounds like an incredible event.
Well, thank you, Sally, and I'll do two things, because the Fisherman's Ball is a big fundraiser, and the tickets, sadly, are not cheap, but there's something that we're doing also that I'll talk about after I talk about the Fisherman's Ball that is not only free, but you get a drink afterwards if you want one. The Fisherman's Ball helps Riverkeeper. It's responsible for almost a third of our budget, so it's a big deal. And we honor somebody in our movement who's deserving, and we have it at Chelsea Piers on the west side of Manhattan, right out in the Hudson River Park. And this year we're honoring someone, I don't know how to find anybody more deserving than Mark Ruffalo. And many of you, I'm sure, have seen Mark's work for clean water and sustainable energy, and he is just a rock for our movement. So I'm so proud to be working with him, so excited to know him, and Glenn Close is going to welcome people at the beginning of the evening. Bobby Kennedy, of course, my wonderful colleague, is going to be making a presentation and a speech and giving the award. We give our big fish award every year to the most deserving environmentalists. So Mark is that guy this year. We're also honoring Ron Gatto, a wonderful environmental enforcement official who's going to be getting our Environmental Defender Award. So, you know, if you can come, check it out, have a look, we'd love to have you. It's on Tuesday at 6:30 at Chelsea Piers. And if you cannot come to our Fisherman's Ball, please sign up for one of our shoreline cleanups for the Riverkeeper Sweep on May 11. And this is a day of service. We have over 70 different locations from the tip of New York City all the way up north to Albany. And everybody gets out on the river, and we have a great time. I did it at Croton Point Park last year. And then at 8 different locations throughout the Hudson Valley, taverns and micropubs and breweries are welcoming people in for a free drink to celebrate their commitment to the wonderful Hudson. So lots of stuff to be done. You know, the battles on the environment aren't getting any easier. If anything, they're getting much, much harder. But the grassroots is in the house for these battles, and that's why we're going to win them.
Well, thank you, Paul Galley, Riverkeeper, for the Hudson River and for the drinking water for New York. I would like to also thank Carrie Wabel. Am I saying her name correctly?
You are.
Carrie Wabel, who has made this interview possible, and I will be on the green carpet in my jeans at the ball, interviewing everyone who comes, and hopefully I will get to interview you yet again, but on videotape this time.
Well, thank you, Sally. It's really been great being on the show.
Well, Joanna Posterly, do you know
Tina.
Joanna Posterly?
Tina Posterly. Tina's one of
Tina,
my colleagues.
Tina. She's the lady who I traveled up to shut down Indian Point with.
Sure.
And
sure.
I'd like to send my best regards to her as well.
I'll make sure she gets that.
Thank you very much, Paul Galley, Riverkeeper. Please, this is going to be the event of the year on Tuesday, April 16th. Please get your tickets directly below this interview. And so thank you to you, Paul Galley, and I look forward to meeting RFK Jr. because he is an activist regarding autism, and this is Autism Awareness Month, so I'm looking forward to meeting him in that regard. And of course, Mark Ruffalo, who also participated in a video where he called for people who are making a lot of money to pay their fair share of taxes. I wanted to adopt him at that moment, but I realized he's not as young as I see him in the film. But like, well, I can't adopt a full-grown man.
Well, we all
but
want
I
to
just
adopt.
Thought I,
we
yeah,
all want to adopt.
Very,
Mark.
Very
we
cool.
also want. We also want to clone him. We need more like him.
Right. Exactly. And we need more like you, Paul Galley. It is really a privilege to speak with you. Thank you
ever
so much.
My pleasure, Sally. Bye now.
Bye-bye now.